I think the probably the misunderstanding with it is that people sort of in, say in the States, instead of buying a 5.3 liter LS engine from a junkyard for $200 that you can make 700 or 800 horsepower at the wheels with, I'm going to buy this Barra because I'll be different. But they don't have the rod strength to do it. You just send rods out the block. Even the early turbo engines, the rods would go out the block.
Welcome to the HPA Tuned In podcast. I'm Andre, your host, and in this episode, we're joined by Al Butler, host of the Skid Factory YouTube channel. In this episode, we find out about Al's background and how he became a mechanic, how being a mechanic has changed from the earlier days in the 70s, 80s, and 90s through to the sorts of cars we see today, and how that's impacting the skill set that modern mechanics have. On top of this, we find out about his involvement with Mighty Car Mods and how he spun this off into his own YouTube channel. We talk about hosting a YouTube channel and how this can become a legitimate source of income. If you're familiar with Al, you've probably already heard his nickname Turbo Yoda, and we do dive fairly deep down the rabbit hole of turbochargers, turbo sizing, and wastegate location in this episode. Lastly, we also couldn't go past the conversation with Al without talking to him about how and why they decided to cut up a Japanese classic, specifically a 1970s Nissan Skyline. Before we get into our chat with Al, if you are new to the HPA Tuned In podcast, High Performance Academy is an online training school. We teach via video-based training courses how to build performance engines, tune factory and aftermarket engine management systems, how to build complete custom reliable wiring harnesses. We also cover motorsport fabrication and race car setup and data analysis. All of these are done via video-based training courses that you can take from the comfort of your own home. If you are interested in learning more about our courses, you can check them out at hpacademy.com/courses. As a podcast listener, you can also use the coupon code podcast75. That'll get you $75 off the purchase of your very first HPA course. And we'll put a link in the description. All right, let's get into our chat now. All right, welcome to the podcast, Al. Thanks for joining us today. And as usual, let's get a little bit of your history. How did you get started in the car scene?
If we want to go back a long way, I grew up on a farm. And of course, everything had to be fixed, you know, in-house and with whatever twine or barbed wire they could find to make things work. So I sort of grew up with my father just watching him make things work. And this was, you know, late 70s, 80s sort of thing. So there wasn't a lot of money around for a start. So there was a lot of do what you can, make it work, don't spend any money. And you sort of pick up the ingenuity involved in that sort of thing. I came out of school in the early 90s and to be honest, the only thing I ever thought I wanted to do was be a mechanic. It was the only thing that interested me. So I went down that path via TAFE courses, which is like a community college, I suppose you'd call it if you're in the States. I don't know what they call it in New Zealand, but
I guess here in New Zealand, it'd be our polytechnics, but basically a trade school, essentially.
Yeah, it's a trade school. So it's a starter course. And then once you've got that, you've sort of a bit more desirable to be brought in as an apprentice, I suppose. So
you do that as a precursor to becoming an apprentice?
Yeah, they call it a pre-vocational course. So you sort of does your first 6 months of your first year of your apprenticeship.
Right. And that gets you up to a kind of a basic level of knowledge so that you're actually of some use to a potential employer.
Yeah, I guess that's the story behind it. Yeah. So following that, I began my apprenticeship. And as I mentioned earlier when we were chatting, it was a rural dealership for Volkswagen, Subaru and Holden. So it was a bit of a strange mix. So we got to do a lot of, you know, we'd service brand new Subarus and 20-year-old Subarus and brand new Holdens and combis, like the original combis and all sorts of strange stuff. And so that was a fairly unusual sort of way to do an apprenticeship as well, which brought lots of interesting things and skills. So
I guess a lot of apprentices these days would maybe go into a franchise dealership where, let's say, they're dealing specifically with GM or Ford or whatever it may be. Do you think that there's advantages with that variation that you had during your apprenticeship and learning how different manufacturers go about the way they build their cars?
100%. I don't really think that the apprenticeship systems works very well in Australia anymore, but it's not really my department, so I can't do anything about it. So I won't comment too much, but yeah, I'd say if you really were a young person, you wanted to get into it, you'd be better off sort of coming in on a non-dealership would probably be the best, but at the same time, a dealership can offer you sort of knowing your place, the hierarchy, knowing that you are going to spend a couple of years cleaning the floor and doing what you're told, and that's also required.
One of the things I'm interested in, because I sort of came through my own career learning mechanical skills, but I'm not a qualified mechanic. And what I've sort of seen over the couple of decades or more now I've been in the scene is that the job of a mechanic has changed quite dramatically. And I don't want to detract from mechanics who are listening to this, but what I'm getting at is, you know, from what you're saying yourself, what you were doing back in those days probably quite varied and a lot more hands-on. And these days, there's a lot more involvement with learning how to use a scan tool to diagnose faults. And of course, a lot of modern vehicles don't come out with cam belts. So the servicing on the actual engine of doing a cam belt, now it's a chain that doesn't necessarily need servicing. A lot of those skills may be lacking a little bit. Is that fair in your opinion?
I agree. Like there's probably a lot less of the tearing down an engine and replacing a timing belt and putting it back together, which you probably, after you've done it 1,000 times, which you do, you obviously know that by heart and you're not going to get it wrong. But yeah, as you said, engines don't really need much work anymore, and that's probably part of it. When do you see a car broken down now? They're just so reliable nowadays. So the main focus of a mechanic is probably just maintaining that reliability and keeping the emissions control under check, which is what the scan tools and the check engine lights are for. So yeah, it has changed as a job, and it's probably moved more to diagnosing wiring faults and stuff like that than ripping into timing belts and that sort of thing like we might have done back in the past.
Yeah, I don't think you'd probably find too many mechanics at a Toyota dealership pulling down a relatively new Yaris to replace the piston rings, for example. That just doesn't happen, does it?
Yeah, unlikely. That far more likely to just put a short motor in it or long or whatever. I don't know why that's the case, but that's just how the businesses are run. That's more to the point.
On that note then, so for our listeners who are interested in maybe going down a mechanical path, but if they're listening to this podcast, probably it's more of a performance related element. Any advice you'd give on that front, sort of if you want to build those skills of being able to go further than just drive a scan tool and actually, you know, get your hands dirty and build engines, tear them down, all of those skills that maybe are starting to get lost a little bit. And again, I don't want to get offside with the mechanics listening and getting really angry with me. It's just my observation.
Well, I don't think it's really changed that much from when I was as an apprentice. We worked on our own cars to do performance work. We weren't building high performance combis. we were just fixing cars. And of course you learn how stuff works by fixing it. But as far as modifying cars, we just worked on our own cars and our friends' cars, and that's where you had to have it as a secondary interest or do it as a side project more so. So I don't think it's realistic for a young person to go, I like performance cars, I want to get an apprenticeship in a performance workshop, because that's just not really how it works. You do have to sort of do the hard yards, learn how to be a normal mechanic, you know, just fixing normal vehicles, then sort of expand on that outside of your work. And to be fair, I don't think too many performance workshops are taking on apprentices, because they really need qualified tradesmen that are going to perform day in, day out to make it worthwhile. Having run a workshop, you would know that.
Yeah, a performance workshop's not really the place where you want to be learning or teaching someone from scratch. There's a higher potential for expensive disaster if something goes wrong, for sure.
Very much so.
But I mean, I think your point is really accurate there. I mean, getting the basics as a mechanic and then applying those and learning in the performance realm on your own vehicles or your friends. And I mean, essentially, that's the path I went down while I was learning. Let's get back to things. We've sort of derailed that a little bit, but let's go through your mechanical apprenticeship. What happened when you came out the end of that?
I left the dealership pretty soon afterwards. The dealership also had a suspension workshop connected to it, so it had that another level. So I spent a bit of time there. So I had a bit of time. We would do old, like things like reaming kingpins from the 50s, and just it was a really old 1950s workshop. And I ended up leaving that whole business because it got sold off, and then working at basically a more modern version of that suspension wheel alignment workshop where I learned a lot of stuff there as well. Obviously, suspension, not racing suspension, but just basics, the basics of how suspension worked, and did thousands of wheel alignments and that sort of thing. And I was there for a few years, and then I eventually started working at a Subaru specialist, which was actually a wrecking yard or a recycler or whatever you call it in your country. But we did repairs as well, and I had a really well-equipped workshop. So that sort of drew me into the Subaru world, and I always liked the cars because they were so much better built than something like Holden, although Holdens have their merits. The build quality, as you'd know, the Japanese stuff back in the 90s was incredibly well built, especially when it was actually built in Japan. And that sort of attracted me to to that brand, for all the things that they have wrong with them, particularly now. So, yeah, that's where I got more into really modifying cars. More so, just grew more skills and became more confident in what I was doing was probably the thing.
The cars of that era, and I'm sort of taking a bit of a guess around the exact era, but you know, the advent of some of the Japanese four-wheel drive turbo cars, and we had the same in New Zealand, Subaru, and of course the Mitsubishi Evolutions, that sort of heralded in a new era in terms of available performance, because prior to that, I mean, I'm guessing in the Australian domestic market, you're sort of dealing with the 5-litre naturally aspirated Holden engine or the equivalent in the Ford realm. And, typically, and these days it might be a little bit different, but typically, to get a significant increase in power out of one of those is going to require some hardware modifications and usually a fairly healthy chunk of cash to get there. Whereas with the modern crop of turbo cars, often a sizable increase in performance is available with nothing more than a little bit more boost. Is that sort of match your experience?
Yeah, to clarify, I was into turbo stuff when I was 18 years old. I was fascinated by the engines that would come in from Japan, like FJ20 turbos. And I mean, that's an old engine now, and it was 10 or 15 years old even then. But that was just an amazing piece of engineering in my eyes back then, and that was sort of something that I'd always wanted, was a Datto with one of those in it. And we love rotaries again. Just it was probably because of the fascination with how the thing operated. Again, for all their faults, you don't know that at the time. And seeing those cars and how they were built versus how a Holden was built, in my experience, say, it was night and day. And it was sort of something you had to go, well, why is that like that? Why is this like this? This is obviously better. But in hindsight, there's always reasons for that, of course.
It's an interesting perspective, because I've spent a fair bit of time in Australia, and there is a diehard Australian enthusiast base that is Holden and Ford, and I'm talking local Australian domestic market. And I mean, it's no different. Of course, we go to the US and there's those that are staunch US domestic market lovers, and they will never look at a Japanese domestic model car. It seems like you cover both bases quite happily and are a little bit more objective in what you prefer and why.
Yeah, I've owned Holden V8s and older Holdens with probably had Japanese engines in them by then, but that's another story. But I just look at things via technical merit, really. And some of what I like about particularly Commodores is they're just so simple, and they've got a sort of reasonable rear end. If you want to go drag racing, it's got a big engine bay. You can stick whatever engine you like in it. You can buy all the parts for it. It's just easy.
Good platform to build off.
Yeah, and I mean, the engines, they're not that they're not that great, but they're not terrible. And sometimes playing with cards is just about improving what you've got, not necessarily having the best thing to start with. It's you get that satisfaction of working on a car because you go 160 kilowatts in your Holden V8 and get 200. That's still improving it. It's just not as easy as if you put boost onto it.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you've been nicknamed by Mighty Car Mods as Turbo Yoda. So let's talk a little bit about this. We've already sort of dived into the fact, obviously, you've developed an interest in turbochargers. You know, how did that sort of evolve?
Well, the Mighty Car Mods involvement came out of Subaru. Me being a Subaru specialist, and that was sort of when forums came into play in the 2000s, and, you know, everyone, if you had common interests, you were on a forum. In our case, it was the RS Liberty Club or RS Legacy, as you guys would call them. And that was a huge sort of fan base and knowledge base. And I was sort of one of the elder guys that was a mechanic that knew stuff about, like, really specific fixes for them. I was working on them all the time and also doing engine conversions, converting the non-turbo ones to turbo. So I ended up becoming sort of internet friends with Marty from Mighty Car Mods. And then eventually, 10 years later, they invited me to do some work on one of their project cars. And they just named me Turbo Yoda because I was old and I knew stuff about turbos. But that's just a stage name, I suppose, which stuck. And I have no problems with it. I certainly don't. My wife doesn't call me Turbo Yoda, but I don't. I expect people to just come up to me in the street and address me as that, which is fine.
Yeah, but Al works quite well too.
Al works perfectly well. That's what we call me on my own show.
Let's talk about the turbocharging side of things, because I've sort of, right from day dot, turbocharged engines was always what sort of I was interested in. I just saw them as a better alternative, and this is arguable, of course, to a big capacity V8 that's naturally aspirated. And particularly through my drag racing career, like, just learning how much power we could get out of these small capacity engines by using the right size turbocharger and obviously running a lot of boost on the right fuel, there's a lot that goes into it, was really an eye opener. When it comes to the modern crop of turbochargers we've got access to now, how has the technology of the turbochargers evolved, in your opinion? What's changed, and how has that impacted what we can do?
Well, it's definitely changed, like, phenomenally over the years, particularly in the last 10 years. And back in the day, when ball bearing turbos came out, we thought, oh, well, ball bearings, this is the key to making a turbo good, which clearly isn't really the case. Like, it's a journal bearing turbo will do just the same job as a ball bearing, but we didn't know that at the time. But I think really what's brought things into play is understanding the relationship between the turbine and the compressor. And it's for years they used to put giant compressors on small turbines, and they just didn't really work very well, or they didn't have anything to compare it with. Is probably one of the things. Like, you'd get those old 30-40s, like a 82 mil compressor on a GT30 turbine that was tiny, and HKS sold them, and that, so they must have been good, and people used to use them, but they just didn't really work very well because of no turbine flow. So I think it's more commonly for people to understand the relationship between turbine flow and compressor flow, and how it's got to be right, or neither of them can work properly, I guess is the key to it.
Yeah, I think hybrid turbos were definitely a popular option when I was early on in my career. And by hybrid turbo, I mean you would take the factory turbocharger off whatever engine, because back in the day we didn't have such easy accessibility to the aftermarket turbo range we've got now. So you'd send it to some turbo specialist, and they'd basically machine the compressor cover to take a larger diameter compressor wheel. And that's basically getting to what you're saying there. You've got an improvement in compressor flow. So technically you can flow more air into the engine, but you also need to get more exhaust gas out. So that's where the consideration of the turbine wheel comes in.
Well, we used to do that with rotary turbos, like series 4 and 5 single turbos, because they did have a reasonably big turbine compared to anything else on a petrol engine. And I don't think we actually even knew what we were doing, but we would put them into Nissans because it was like a millimeter difference. It was all based on Garrett stuff, but some were made by Hitachi and some were Garrett. And you could make them work if you had a machine, or, you know, got a machine out your housing. And there was improvements, but I think we ended up sticking that big turbine into a very, very, very small exhaust housing and killing it that way anyway. But I mean, I was experimenting. We didn't know what we were doing. And, you know, if you don't try, you never know. But
oh, I think you've got to mess around and sort of find out what works and what doesn't sometimes. And you learn more from that experience than picking a off-the-shelf component, bolting it on and just getting a result. Coming back to the journal bearing versus ball bearing, roller bearing turbos, you know, these days, most of the performance turbos really seem to be ball bearing turbos. As you mentioned, though, the journal bearing, there's nothing necessarily wrong with it. And I think there's a lot of misunderstanding or misinformation about the place of the journal bearing. And it really comes down to one of, as I see it at least, you may have a different opinion or view on it, one of the main failure causes with a journal bearing turbocharger when we're using a performance application running a lot of boost is actually the thrust bearing. Whereas the way the ball bearing is constructed, the ball bearing center is constructed, that actually gives a lot more strength and support in thrust. Is that sound about right?
Yeah, 100%. Like the ball bearings does thrust load and like axial load. So that's really what kills them is trying to push that compressor through the middle of the core when you're running big boosts. But at the same time, a truck runs 30, 40 PSI boost all day long, 12 hours a day. And they're not based on ball bearing, generally speaking. They're just bigger and they've got a better design of
essentially a thrust bearing that is designed for the task. And I remember back in the Nissan days with general bearing turbos, I think it was Nissan, if my memory serves correct, and they come out in stock form with a sort of 180-degree, I think they were called a horseshoe thrust washer or thrust bearing. And it was easy to assemble because you slotted it over the shaft, so nice and easy, but it didn't actually give full 360 degree support. So then there were aftermarket 360 degree thrust bearings. So you know, then oil flow comes into it. So there's a lot into it, but basically, long story short, a journal bearing turbo is not sort of the kiss of death, is it? You can actually make one reliable and they can work really well, even at high boost applications.
Yeah. I believe some of the big turbo, like really, really large turbos just have the thrust is not a thrust plate. It's a like a Torrington bearing or whatever. But I mean, it's probably just easier to make the whole thing a decent sort of ball bearing, which does both jobs, or you know, it's fixing both problems. So you may as well do it that way.
How about in terms of the improvements we've seen? Obviously, technology has improved with the materials that are available, manufacturing techniques, and also you know, understanding of aerodynamics, the ability to use software packages to analyze and kind of validate the performance of a potential compressor and turbine wheel before they ever go into manufacturing. So how has that helped advance turbo technology over the last decade?
It certainly helped the end user to pick the right unit for their application. We've only sort of just recently started putting like exhaust manifold pressure sensors, temperature and pressure before the intercooler, afterwards as well, sort of so you can see what's going on through the whole system. But that wasn't that easy to do just with a single ECU a few years ago because they just didn't have the inputs and outputs to be able to do all the things that were primarily important to run the engine and then add all those extras in as well just for data logging. So the current crop of, you know, sort of higher end ECUs, I'd call them, have enough IO that you can do that and you may as well take advantage of it. I still don't think they get it right a lot of the time though. Like it's particularly Garrett. I don't want to, you know, pick on a particular brand because they do make a quality product that stays alive in high performance applications. But the selection of turbine to compressor is limited. Like it doesn't seem to be, you can't pick your exact setup that would suit your application because, you know, like a larger capacity engine, you're going to need a way bigger turbine, even though you want to make the same power as you do out of a 2JZ or whatever, where you can get away with a smaller turbine without choking the engine. So
essentially what you're saying is there for a given compressor wheel size on the larger engine, for the same power target, you're going to want to upspec the turbine size to increase the exhaust flow.
Well, yeah, even if you want to make the same amount of power out of a 8-liter engine as a 4-liter engine, you're still going to have to change that turbine size. Otherwise, it'll choke the engine's exhaust flow. So it's some brands allow you to do that. Garrett's a little bit less so, I suppose, but And also, well, then you go get into making your own turbo, I suppose, which is less common nowadays because the aftermarket stuff is just better and a little bit better spec'd. The problem is you buy a $5,000 turbo, test it, and it doesn't work, and you still own it. So, we've done that before.
I guess the million-dollar question that always comes up then is how do you go about sizing a turbocharger? And, I mean, we could have probably a series of podcasts on that topic alone. So I'm going to put you under the pump here and ask you to sort of dilute that down into a few minutes rather than a few hours. But what advice can you give to our listeners?
Of course, it depends on application. If it's drag and you're trans-braked and automatic, you can do whatever you need to do to get that thing to come up on boost, then you just go bigger in the turbine. Choose your compressor for your power output and go bigger in the turbine. As long as you can get it up, then you know that it's not going to have high exhaust manifold pressure, which is the thing that's sort of starting to be very detrimental in nowadays with what you can get out of a relatively stock engine like a Barra or something like that. You can just make crazy power out of them, but the exhaust manifold pressures are phenomenal on them in our testing. And we didn't know before because we didn't have the stuff to test it with or the knowledge, you know. Like, I'm learning all the time. I don't claim to be a turbo expert despite the nickname, but yeah, I think choose your compressor and don't skimp on the turbine. And of course that also relates to the size of the engine. So there are obviously, like, BorgWarner has a thing called MatchBot, which when you first look at it, well, it's to match, it's for you to try and figure out which turbo you need. It is pretty daunting to look at initially. It's very technical, sort of. It's above my pay grade, that's for sure. But as far as from me taking knowledge from other people that are smarter than I am and have got more experience, them explaining how it works and knowing what data to put into it, it does spit out what you need. It is reasonably accurate. You got to know the data. You got to know the data to put in so it'll get you the result that you want.
The nice thing with MatchBot, because I've used it a couple of times and you're absolutely right, it is on face value when you first open it up, looks pretty daunting and, you know, where the hell am I going to get this data? The nice thing with MatchBot is, first of all, there are some, I think from memory, a little question marks you can hover over that will give you a bit of a guide on what a particular parameter is, or maybe even give you some sort of suggestions of common, you know, ballpark numbers. The other thing, though, that I think probably a lot of people wouldn't know is that there is a series of YouTube tutorial videos by BorgWarner on how to use MatchBot. So if you're prepared to put in a little bit of time, it is really powerful. What I quite like with it, though, is you can really see exactly how a certain turbo compressor and turbine combination is going to sort of fit with your engine, particularly when you're sort of starting to push the limits. And one of the problems we see with some of these small capacity engines with really big turbos is running them potentially into surge, which we want to stay away from. So you can sort of map it out and see exactly where that's going to sit on the compressor map and make sure that you're staying away from surge. So that's quite a powerful tool if you're prepared to put the time into getting to use it. Now, I wanted to come back because you mentioned sizing the compressor for your power aims, and obviously that makes sense. The other element, though, that you've sort of referred to there is your turbine wheel and housing sizing, and this relates to exhaust manifold back pressure. There's a tricky relationship, which you kind of alluded to here, in terms of choosing your application. And a turbo that's going to be perfect for drag is probably going to be an absolute dog if it's a street car. And I think too many people forget about that. The boost threshold and the boost response are just going to be absolutely garbage. And that doesn't matter because, like you say, you're on boost from the time you come off the trans brake and that's it. You're just on it. So this relating back to exhaust manifold back pressure, can you give us an idea of sort of where you like to be in terms of EMAP on a particular application? Let's say drag, for example, because you brought that up.
Well, I mean, ideally you'd like to be under 1:1, so your boost pressure and your exhaust manifold are, you know, the same, or it's below it. Your EMAP is below your boost pressure. But that's definitely potentially a bit of a fantasy number. I mean, I'm sure with enough research and development, you probably could have it at that. And I know people do sort of celebrate the fact that they've achieved that. But in reality, the sort of stuff that we've been doing with, like, Barra drag cars, you know, sort of 1,300 horsepower at the hub sort of engines, are running like 2:1 back pressure. And I know that that in theory is not what it should be, but we've tried messing around with bigger turbines and like changing from G42 to 45, for instance, and it achieved nothing. And then it makes me think, well, it's like it can't go up. I think it's somewhere in the vicinity of 10 mil bigger turbine. Like it's quite a reasonable size upgrade. And it didn't make much difference, and it should.
It should, yeah.
Yes.
On paper. Absolutely. And can I assume that without, you saw no real advantage, but can I assume it killed the boost response?
It definitely affected it, yeah. It sort of required notches to be added to actually get it up on the brake, so whereas that wasn't necessary on a 42.
This is where sometimes I think you look at a catalogue or look at all of the information provided and you can do your homework and come up with this theoretical sort of perfect combination. But I think turbo matching is mostly science, but then there is a little bit of art to it as well. And sometimes you literally just have to go through a couple of combinations and see how they actually work on the dyno in the real world.
Yeah, I mean, in reality, they probably put 10 different variants of a turbo onto a road car engine or any engine in the engineering phase of it to try and find the one that works properly. It's not, they don't just go, oh, this one will be fine and whack it on and it just works. They're working with like an OEM engineer would be working with a whole bunch of different turbine sizes and maybe compressor sizes.
A little bit better funded and resourced than we are in the aftermarket.
Of course, yeah. Yeah, you got to sort of throw $5,000 at a turbo and get data out of it and not much else, which can be very sort of disheartening, I guess you'd call it.
No one likes spending a lot of money and getting nothing in return.
Yeah, and there's always been someone that has had to do that. And then eventually you'll probably find you can Google it. And if it's a common engine, there'll be a spec for a street LS that makes this much power. You use this turbo and it'll just work.
Yeah. I think for common combinations, if you're not chasing down world records or trying to, you know, do something that's never been done before, the sensible option is, yeah, spend some time on enthusiast forums, see what other people are using. You'll almost certainly find dozens of build threads, dozens of dyno picks, and you can kind of get a sense after, you know, there's a bit of sorting fact from fiction as well, but you know, you spend enough time and you can start to see some common turbo sizes come out of it, and you can be pretty confident then with spending your money knowing approximately what you're going to get. That of course doesn't work when you're chasing world records, because no one really wants you to know what they're running, so they're more likely to actually feed you a little bit of bullshit than tell you what the actual spec is. So obviously goes without saying, you need to tread a little bit more carefully.
Yeah, the internet is an incredible resource, but it's got to be definitely treated as at 50% right and 50% wrong, and you just have to keep looking and see if you can find a lot more rights than wrongs, and then it's the same as talking to people in person, of course, as well. It's just published on the internet. And also podcasts are a great resource, because in a situation like this, you'll find people are a lot more relaxed about the way they're talking about it. And some of the stuff you've done with some of the race team guys, it just blows my mind how easily they sort of let go of some information that I would normally think that they would be less likely to share.
I've actually had a few reach out maybe an hour or a few hours or a day or two after a podcast has been recorded and go, hey, so I don't think I should have probably been talking about that. So yeah, I think it's quite good, because as you say, it's normally a fairly flowing and an open conversation. I mean, we understand obviously some of the people we talk to have NDAs in place, so they have to be a little bit more cautious about what they talk about. I just want to come back to exhaust manifold pressure just momentarily again, and I'm adding some big rules of thumb in here, but generally the higher the exhaust back pressure relation to boost pressure, we're going to generally get faster boost response, but the thing's going to sort of strangle in the top end, and vice versa, very very low EMAP in relation to boost pressure. Generally there's not a lot of drive pressure to actually build boost, so boost response and boost threshold go up. My old drag car high-redundancy usable boost into about 6,500 RPM as an example. But of course, it's much freer flowing. There's less restriction to the exhaust flow, so we can potentially make more power. Are there other considerations with engines running high exhaust back pressure in terms of not just choking it of power, but is it harder on engine internal components? Are there any other considerations, exhaust gas temperature, etc., that you see?
Yeah, obviously the exhaust gas temperature is going to be higher if it's, I mean, you can have valve float as well from just that back pressure pushing on your exhaust valve, but it depends on what sort of engine it is as well. Like an engine that's built for like incredibly harsh environment, it's not going to matter as much. But if you slap a turbo on a stock engine and just send it and that turbo's too small, it's going to damage the engine for sure. Like you're putting something that's already running at a high temperature under pressure at an even higher temperature, it's going to wreck things. So I've definitely changed to more of a go the larger turbine and deal with it type of attitude and exhaust housing as well. Of course, once you've chosen your turbine, you've then got the options of different turbine housings, and I'm more leaning towards the larger housing in most cases to get the actual turbine flow that the turbine's advertised in relation to what size housing you're choosing as well. So if you have a look at the published data, you'll see that the turbine flow is governed by the size of the housing at the end of the day as well. So
it does come down to, again, to reiterate, it's application specific.
Application specific, yeah, for sure.
That technique might not work so well if it's a street-driven car that's never going to see a racetrack or a drag strip, because you're going to sacrifice response and low boost threshold, which is really important in a street-driven car.
Yeah, it's going to be horrible to drive and probably boring because you're never going to get it on boost. That's definitely a consideration, but in all out sort of in a drag application where you didn't have to worry about that so much, then you definitely lean towards the larger size. And
yeah, I think I've probably transitioned a little bit as I've gone through my career. I started with drag racing, and that's really exactly what you're talking about, where for all intents and purposes, bigger is better. We want as little exhaust back pressure as we can. And as I said, with my 4G63, it was sort of 6.5 grand. It really started making measurable boost. And the power band was sort of 7.5, 8 through to sort of 10.5, 11,000 RPM, which doesn't sound like much because it isn't. And I mean, that car would have been absolutely horrible to drive on the street, but that's not what it was for. Keep it in the power band and hold on. I mean, at the time, it held a world record, so happy days. And as I've sort of moved through my career, and I'm more interested now in circuit racing, road racing, and we developed a Toyota 86 for that purpose. And we used a little BorgWarner EFR 6758 on that. And I've had people drive that car and not being able to tell that it's turbocharged. The turbo sizing, at least for our power aims on that, I think were absolutely spot on, and it just simply feels like maybe a 3 or 3.5 litre engine instead of the FA22 litre. But, you know, that's going to be dog shit on the drag strip. So it really is horses for courses, I think. You can't sort of stress that enough. Now, I just wanted to talk a little bit while we're on this turbo topic as well about wastegating. Over my time tuning cars, this is one of the areas that I constantly saw problems with. And it was sort of around the integration of the wastegate to the exhaust manifold, sizing of the wastegate, and then boost control. So can we start with the basics? Maybe what's your sort of take on how do we know what size wastegate we should be going with? We also see people using two wastegates versus a single. Yeah, give us your feedback on that.
Sizing, I mean, that does come down to the size of the turbine housing as well, but it's kind of difficult to put a wastegate on that's actually too big. They're only sort of usually about 50 mil nowadays anyway. They used to have bigger ones back in the HKS days and that sort of thing. But that's actually, that's a difficult one to answer with as far as sizing goes. That's a very specific to what size the engine is and what size the turbo is, I suppose. But as far as twins go, that's normally trying to split like a twin scroll turbo up so you're not getting reverse, like something where you're trying to get maximum response out of it like they normally would do in a Evo engine with the twin scroll setup. Don't really see any point in running twins other than that,
normally if you've got a single entry turbocharger, it would be hard to see why you would need twin wastegates. I mean, with the split pulse manifold, I think there's sort of there's two schools of thought on that. Obviously, from purely if we're looking at making sure that the manifold is divided right up to the turbine wheel, well, that's a clear winner. There's no interaction. Much more difficult to integrate a single wastegate to a split pulse manifold and maintain that separation right up to the valve. Not impossible, but much more difficult.
It is possible, but it's a lot of messing around with, as far as fabrication goes, and probably a lot easier just to use two small gates by the time you paid someone to do it properly.
Yeah, and then the other downside is in a really cramped engine bay. Can be quite tricky in terms of just packaging constraints with trying to fit two wastegates and dump pipes and integrate those back into the exhaust if that's what you're doing. That gets quite fiddly quite quickly, doesn't it?
Yeah, and well, cost, of course. You've got to buy two of them instead of one. I guess the big thing with wastegates that we found over the years is once the modern exhaust manifold, as we probably know it nowadays, with the, you know, that you'd see on a six-cylinder or whatever with the merge collector, once that sort of became more common, we found that the wastegates no longer worked anymore.
Okay.
The merge worked so well that the wastegate was ignored. And that could also change depending on what size the exhaust behind the turbo was. I had a performance workshop 10 years ago. And, you know, so we might get a car in that's got all that stuff on, it's working fine. Oh, let's upgrade the exhaust from 3 to 3.5 inch. We'd fabricate a 3.5 inch exhaust for it, and all of a sudden there's no boost control anymore. And we would have to remove the wastegate from the merge on the merge collector and put it in the exhaust housing.
Sure.
To get it to work. And it caused a lot of headaches and
I've been through that exact scenario myself, and you don't realize at the time the restrictive factory exhaust is creating so much back pressure post turbocharger that it's actually, for want of a better term, essentially helping the flow out the wastegate. You get rid of that back pressure, and all of a sudden, yeah, the wastegate can't keep up. And it's a bit of pill to swallow when you've sort of got a car and you've quoted X thousands of dollars for the aftermarket exhaust and the time to fit it, and then all of a sudden you have to ring up the customer and say, oh, well, actually, so now you also need a new wastegate and a whole bunch of fabrication work to fix your boost control.
You literally can't drive it home. That's the problem.
Always better when you've sort of learned that lesson the hard way and then can advise customers in the same situation before they actually lay down their hard-earned money. So essentially, there's two problems here. One is wastegate sizing, which is sort of touched on. I do agree there's some complexities around just giving a one-size-fits-all answer here on a podcast, so we'll let you off the hook on that. The other element, though, is almost irrespective of wastegate sizing. The exhaust gas actually needs to be able to flow into the wastegate and out of it in order for the wastegate to do its job. And it might sound stupid, but if you've got the wastegate in a spot where it isn't getting favoured flow, you could basically take the wastegate off the manifold, run the car on the dyno, and it will still overboost. So this is about wastegate priority, which is a term we hear thrown around. Can you give us your sort of take on what that term means and anything you sort of see around it?
Prioritising the wastegate, I suppose it's a good term to use to make the wastegate work. But if you're prioritising the wastegate, you may well be like unprioritising the turbine itself, which is also important. So there's got to be a bit of a balance. And a lot of people go to a lot of trouble to make those sort of merge manifolds and stuff like that. And yes, they look incredible and obviously work at what they're doing, but at the same time they make the wastegate not work. So then you enlarge that hole to make the wastegate work. I found that unless you're running it free float unwastegated, you probably don't really need to do it at all. Just design a bit simpler exhaust manifold that can accommodate both of those things, because if you're making it a merge collector, like kind of like it's an NA engine and you want to get that pulsing, that's not going to work anyway. So you may as well just simplify the manifold, keep it free flowing, but have both the wastegate and the turbo accommodated for. And I found that that's what is happening more now with they call them pro mod style manifolds on drag cars, but they're basically, they go into the merge, then they go into a single pipe before they go into the turbo. And then in within that pipe, they can then accommodate a decent wastegate merge and prioritize it that way. So
It's unfortunate we don't obviously have in a podcast the benefit of pictures, but you know, basically what we want to try and do is understand that the exhaust gas is super lazy and it's moving pretty quickly, so it doesn't really like changing direction. So it's about getting the waste gate orientated off the collector or off the exhaust housing, if that's where you're going to do it, in a way that it's easy for the exhaust gas to flow out. And I'll just give a couple of things I see so often which cause issues is we've got what you're talking about there with those merge collectors. I don't see anything specifically wrong with the merge collector, but normally what we see is a twofold issue. You've got the merge collector, but then due to space and packaging constraints, that merge collector is super short, and then you're straight into the turbine housing. So you don't have a lot of room to integrate the wastegate feed. So then the wastegate feed comes off at a 90 degree angle, and remembering the exhaust gas is lazy, doesn't want to turn 90 degrees. Or alternatively, I've seen a few over my time where it's actually coming back against the flow off that merge collector. And so the exhaust gas essentially has to flow back on itself, which it just does not want to do. And I mean, you get that on the dyno, and what it's going to do is sort of through the rev range, it'll come up on boost and the wastegate will open. And let's say you've got a 1 bar spring and it'll hold 1 bar for a bit. And then as the engine comes up in the RPM and the engine becomes more efficient and flows more exhaust gas, the wastegate can't keep up, and you just see that boost curve start going exponential, and there's just nothing you can do to control it. So I think these are simple things that people can keep in mind when they're either buying parts or modifying parts that are going to save them a lot of heartache in the end. What I wanted to get onto, though, is your comment about adding it to the exhaust housing, because we've done a couple of posts on our Instagram about this. It's not an uncommon technique, but it seems from the comments we get that it's quite controversial. A lot of people saying that'll never work, it'll crack, it'll break, it's going to end up affecting the flow when the wastegate isn't open, just to name a few. So you sound like you're a big fan of this technique.
Yeah, I've done it many, many times, and it definitely offers an excellent boost control, and I've never seen it cause any issues with the way the exhaust housing works. I guess you could put it in completely the wrong place if you were really keen. Like, you would normally put it right after the flange of the housing itself. Like, if you put it completely around the other side of the scroll, then obviously that's probably not the greatest spot for it, and it probably wouldn't work very well anyway. But as far as cracking and any of those things go, exhaust housings weld incredibly well, and you just got to do it in a process that is suitable. So preheat, weld, and slow cooling. I've never had a problem with one cracking. They actually weld nicer than a lot of other metals, to be honest. And as far as it disrupting the flow of the turbine housing, that doesn't really compute to me. I think, so you've got your volute inside the housing. So again, we're on a podcast, so it's pretty hard to describe, but it's before that volute. It basically is the same as being in the exhaust manifold. It doesn't make any difference. The only reason it probably works better is because as you're heading towards the nozzle, the pressure's increasing because that's how the turbine is powered. So the closer it is to where that nozzle is, the pressure's becoming higher. So it's then favouring it's looking for an escape. As you said, it's lazy. It doesn't care where it goes. It just wants to get out. So I've found it works great, and a lot of other people have. It's been done here for a long time. Like, I didn't invent it or anything like that. We started doing it because we had problems with wastegate priority flow. That was the only way we could really fix it for a reasonable cost, you know, like to the customer, after you've put a big exhaust on their car and they can no longer drive it. So we only started doing it out of necessity, and I've never seen any evidence that it causes any issues. The only thing it does is make your turbine housing very specific to your car, which is potentially a problem if you wanted to sell the turbo later. But
yeah, it also creates the same exact problem if you decide that you want to change to a different AR housing as well, because obviously you need to go through that whole process again, which obviously isn't cheap. But that probably most people could figure out that little hurdle in their mind anyway. But yeah, I just wanted to talk about that particular subject since you brought it up. I know it's, as you say, it's definitely not a new technique, but it is one that I know has seemingly been quite controversial when we've talked about in the past.
One thing that points to why wouldn't you do it is internal wastegate turbos. There's billions of them around. That's exactly how it's done inside a internal wastegate housing. So what's the difference?
I just wanted to take a moment out of this podcast and just talk about a course that I know that if you're enjoying this podcast, you're also going to love. We've talked so far to Al about performance engine building and what's required. And I think that this is an area that a lot of enthusiasts think is beyond their ability. The truth is that it is absolutely within reach of anyone with an eye for detail and a bit of patience. And we've got a suite of engine building courses that will teach you everything you need to know. I'll highlight one of these, which is our practical engine building course. This teaches you the principles behind building performance engines, and it is not based on one particular engine. This is generic information that you can apply regardless whether you want to build a Barra 4-litre inline 6, a 4AG naturally aspirated 1600cc engine, or maybe a 6.2-litre LS3 with a supercharger. The principles do not change. You'll learn all about the clearances and tolerances inside the engine, the parts and how they integrate. You'll learn how to spec clearances for your particular engine, even if they are a little different to what you'd need for a factory engine. And we know that when you get your parts back from the engine machinist for the first time, it can be a little daunting knowing what to do first and what order to progress in. What we've done within this course is we've broken the entire engine building process down into the HPA 10-step process. By doing this, each of those individual steps is relatively quick and easy to complete. And in no time you've got to the end, you've got a completely built engine, you're going to have the confidence that all of the clearances inside the engine are perfect for your application. You're going to have the confidence that when it comes time to start the engine for the first time, it's going to deliver great horsepower, great torque, and most importantly, great engine reliability. Now, as I've said, this 10-step process is generic, so it doesn't matter what engine you're building. But as part of this course, we also include a library of worked examples. Within that library, we go through that 10-step process on a variety of different engine platforms so you can gain experience on different engines. As with all of our courses, once you've purchased, it's yours for life. You can rewatch the course as many times as you like. It never expires. And to give you confidence as well, with all of our courses, we offer a 60-day, no questions asked, money back guarantee. So if you purchase and decide it's not quite what you expected or not right for you, no problem. Let us know and we'll give you a full refund of the purchase price. We'll put a link to this course in the show notes. Remember, you can also use that coupon code podcast75. That'll get you $75 off the purchase of your very first HPA course. All right, let's get back to our interview now. Now, while we were talking about turbos a little earlier in the conversation, you mentioned the Barra engine, so that's probably a good place to segue and talk a little bit about this. It's an engine that's certainly not anything new in Australia, but it sort of made headlines because it seemingly takes a lot of abuse, makes a lot of power relatively easily, and it's become a bit of a buzzword sort of in other parts of the world that didn't get the Barra engine. So give us the sort of the overview. What is the Barra and why is it so good?
Well, the Barra is, I think it's kind of like an engine that they just worked from the 60s right through and never gave up on. And the Barra is the final incarnation of it, where it's got good metallurgy, it's got accurate tolerances. It's got a really good cylinder head, which, to be fair, the predecessors back into the pushrod crossflow engines, they were actually quite a good cylinder head for their time. But the Barra is obviously four valve. It's got dual variable cam timing, so the engine breathes really well. It makes reasonable power as an NA engine, which, as you know, that makes for a perfect boosted engine because it's already efficient at pumping air. Putting a turbo on a 4-litre engine and making generally makes them go quite well, so it's not really rocket science. The fact that they're common, and they basically used to give them away, excuse me, because it was just out of our very, very simple, basically a taxi. They call them taxi engines. High production, easy to get, cheap. I think the thing that people don't understand is that a $200 Barra is not a strong engine and won't last long at all with any power put through it. You have to turn that $200 engine into a $10,000 engine to make 1,000 horsepower. So
there's still no magic here.
No, not at all.
No shortcuts.
The only engines that are you can make 700 horsepower at the wheels, is an FG turbo engine. Let's say there's a few other ones that could do it. That's a $6,000 engine now, so it's like trying to buy a 2JZ GTE, you know, like it's not worth buying one of them just to try and be the fastest stock block guy, because no one cares. Just starting with a good NA engine and putting the usual parts into it. We did one for a friend of mine, and I think we spent about $10,000 on engine parts. It made as much as the turbo they had on it could possibly make. Let's say that was about 720 horsepower at the wheels. And, I mean, it's definitely capable of well over 1,000. So that's not much of a spend in today's money.
No. And I mean, I guess for our international followers as well, we're talking Australian dollars versus US dollars as well. So yeah, I'm not entirely sure what the exchange rate is, but suffice to say, less than 10,000 US dollars.
I think that probably the misunderstanding with it is that people sort of, in the States, would consider it instead of buying a 5.3 liter LS engine from a junkyard for $200 that you can make 700 or 800 horsepower at the wheels with, I'm going to buy this Barra because I'll be different. But they don't have the rod strength to do it. You just send rods out the block. Even the early turbo engines, the rods would go out the block quite often. I mean, you can manage your way around that with good tuning, which evidently wasn't understood back in the day when people first started flash tuning them, because there was an awful lot of rods flying out the blocks of factory BA turbo engines.
If I remember correctly, I've only done a handful of these engines in my time, but I seem to remember that the earlier turbo ones, the BA turbo, and when I say BA, for those again who aren't aware what we're talking about, this is a model code for the Ford Falcon, the Australian domestic market car. Valve spring was an issue as well, because I think if you wanted to really sort of raise the boost pressure, they ran into valve float. Is my memory correct there?
Yeah, the early engines had all sorts of troubles. I don't want to pick on Ford engineers, but it literally looked like it was an afterthought. The whole system, they just went, oh, let's put a turbo on it and just put an LPG rod in it. They already had those rods for the LPG engine because the LPG engines had very little control over the combustion process. So they just put big rods in them to stop them from breaking. So the whole system was very afterthought looking, and I very much doubt whether they delve too far into the engine itself at all, because they're only running like 4 to 6 PSI. So as soon as people worked out how to get more boost into them, which also took a long time until they actually cracked the factory PCM, so to speak.
If I remember correctly, when that car first came out, that was supposed to be one of the first untunable or uncrackable ECUs, again, if my memory serves correct. But of course, when there's an active aftermarket with a bunch of money to be made, there's a lot of incentive to crack the uncrackable. So yeah, they got there in the end. Now, in terms of these $200 wrecking yard Barra engines, so these are the naturally aspirated engines. I just want to get an understanding. It sounds like regardless whether you're starting with a factory turbo or an NA engine, work is needed and parts are going to be required. But what are the key differences between the turbo and NA variants?
Well, the biggest difference is the rod size that they run. You know, as a lot of late model engines, they reduce the rod size for just to reduce rotating mass. If it doesn't need a big fat rod to handle the torque, the combustion pressure, then they don't put it in there. So the rods were very small and they basically just fold in half and head out the side of the block. So the early engines had a bigger rod, but it still wasn't big enough. People would still throw them out. Again, possibly with bad tuning, trying to get all the power in, all the torque in as low as possible was a big thing, because they weren't a big revving engine. So I guess they were, at the time, it was just like, let's just make the most torque we can, as low as we can, because that makes the car feel fast. And yeah, that quite often ended in tragedy. So they eventually, with the BF, which is just like an update of a BA, started putting a larger conrod in that was more appropriate for the power that the engines could make. And that was when's that, probably mid 2006, something like that. Then after that, all the turbo engines had a decent bottom end that could reliably make 700 horsepower. There's lots of them that will do that. You could push them further if you really wanted to find out what the limits are, but I'm sure some people have. But great engine until they became expensive.
Yeah, okay. And is that when the rest of the world found out about them?
Yeah, I think it was all over by the time the rest of the world found out about them. So, but yeah, again, it was never going to be a $200 engine with that sort of strength inside it. That sort of engine design philosophy went away back in the 90s with 1s and 2 JZs, I think.
So for any listeners thinking about hotting up one of these Barra straight sixes, you know, can you maybe just give us, you've already mentioned sort of parts cost, but maybe give us a quick rundown on your go-to shopping list if you wanted to bolt together something that was going to be reliable around the 1,000 horsepower mark. Obviously, we've got rods. That's pretty clear.
Yeah, just rods and pistons. There's a couple of variations of rods depending on how far you want to go, but I would normally go for the higher spec ones that have got 7/16 bolts in them. Forged pistons, whatever compression ratio you want to play with. We normally go for a little bit higher nowadays because we mostly run things on E85, so the compression ratio is not super. I mean, obviously, we're not going to run 12-1 or anything like that, but we don't need to run 8.5-1.
What would you sort of, where are you happy with on E85?
9.5 if you're throwing 40 pound into them. So, yeah, E85 fixes everything except for rods breaking from putting too much timing in or all those things, but that's just strength stuff. Crankshafts are pretty good. Guys that are going max effort will buy a new Ford crank and then nitride it and balance them, of course. Oil pump is the thing that lets down a lot of them. The gears break because they're sort of sintered metal, like powdered metal. That's pretty much it. Anything that you're fiddling with, you'd normally replace the gears straight away before your engine dies. Head studs, again, that depends on how much power you're shooting for. They put 9/16 studs into big power engines, but you would probably just put screw-in replacement stuff. A metal head gasket, which they already have anyway, but usually they use multi-layered, three-layer ones instead of single. Valve springs, you can put cams in them if you want, but you probably don't really need it. Most people do because they sound horrible. It's the least performance-sounding engine you've ever heard, being a long-stroke, large-capacity six. Yeah, just they don't sound lovely. And girdle plate across the main studs, and quite often now we would go for a billet main cap as well while you're there, because you've spent all this other money and you may as well. That ups the machining cost quite significantly because you've got to line bore it and that sort of thing. But it's one of those things, you get scope creep, you start throwing stuff into an engine and it...
Where do you stop?
Yeah, that's it. But relatively easy to build, you know, that you can build a very stout engine, and they make power and they do it very reliably with good tunes. So it's certainly an excellent engine for drag racing.
At the pointy end, you know, what are some of the guys running records down the strip making out of the Barra?
I think if it's full send, don't care about what happens. One of the well-known Melbourne guys, they ran their road drag car, like it's registered. They did like 2,200 horsepower at the wheels on a dyno at a car festival.
Okay, that's pretty stout.
Obviously, that was they expected it not to last, but it did.
Get that one Hail Mary run in and that's it.
100%, that's what it was, yeah. So 1,800 horsepower is, as you know, it's not going to last at that, but it is going to do a meeting or two, get refreshed, that sort of thing. So it's pretty reasonable. And we do drag and drive stuff, so, you know, like drag week and that sort of stuff, and they're kind of better for that because they don't have a problematic valve train. The valve trains, it's just finger followers. There's no push rods, lifters, rockers, all that stuff that breaks.
Nothing to really fly off.
Yeah, it's a lot less complex. So they have an advantage in that regard as well.
Yeah, okay. All right. One thing that hasn't come up, and I've just seen this firsthand. I haven't dealt with this engine too much, but I have seen this firsthand through engine swaps. They are physically a very tall engine, aren't they? Just as a consideration for those considering an engine swap.
Yeah, that's correct. It's a long stroke engine, 4-litre capacity, so it's pretty big. And also the thing that makes them even worse is that they have the variable cam timing function is in the front of the cylinder head, so it has a lump right where you don't want it, where your bonnet line would normally want it to be nice and flat. It isn't. But generally speaking, they'll fit into anything that other straight sixes fit into. So they're pretty flexible, but trying to stick them into, like, well, we've got a friend that's got one in a K30 Corolla or a K20, and obviously it's halfway inside the car, you know, like it's a race car, of course, but yeah.
It's a lot of engine for a small car.
Yeah, it's a 7-second car, so you got to pick your vessel to put it in, but generally speaking, they're a pretty good option when you're looking at stuff like 2Js or 1Js, that sort of thing. that it's definitely a an alternative if you want to get in that six-cylinder scene.
I want to sort of circle right back, because we've sort of taken a bit of a convoluted discussion to get where we are, and I think we've missed out a bunch of your career in terms of what you're doing now. So we got the sort of the mechanical background, the working at the performance, well, owning the performance shop, your involvement with Mighty Car Mods, but we actually haven't dealt with the fact that you're now running a YouTube channel, Skid Factory. So can you kind of tell us how Skid Factory came to be and what it is today?
So it was basically born out of, I guess, from Mighty Car Mods. I was a guest technical expert, I suppose you would call me, on their channel. They aren't mechanics and don't profess to be, so they would often, you know, bring an expert in if they wanted to do something that they felt was out of their comfort zone. So I worked with them for many years on various projects, and we had a lot of fun and we became good friends. And eventually I got out of my the business that I was in partnership with, the performance shop, because I just wanted a change of lifestyle. And I started working at my home. I've got a reasonable workshop at my home, which I always had. And I just started doing sort of a bit more casual single job, be like not 10 jobs a day, just one job every 3 months, sort of performance build sort of thing, which is what I really wanted to do. And at some point, the guys from Mighty Car Mods said, oh, you do really cool stuff, you should film it. So I had never really thought about it, but with their encouragement, I teamed up with a friend, Woody, who's the co-host of the show and cameraman, editor, sort of everything that isn't me standing in front of the camera. So he's also a qualified mechanic, but he's a lot younger than me, and he soon realized coming out of dealership work that there wasn't much of a career in mechanics and not much satisfaction in it. So he actually stopped working as a mechanic and started working in a bottle shop, because he got paid just as much and it was a lot more flexible and less stress, less injuries, less everything. So he was doing that, and he was an avid sort of, he was interested in videography and editing and stuff like that. So we just teamed up and gave it a go. And with their guidance, we spent 6 months on the side doing work on a mate's car. We actually put a 1UZ V8 turbo into an old Fairlane, which was possibly a bit triggering for people, but, well, particularly Americans, they did not like it much at all. But so we did all that.
Tends to get the views and comments, though.
Yeah, and it kicked off pretty well, and we were very wooden and awkward and basically just filmed what we did. And that was published on Mighty Car Mod's other channel. They have an others channel to go along with the one that their main channel. So it went well. We had an instant audience, and we were enjoying ourselves. So eventually we figured that because we had to sort of share the money that comes from it with Mighty Car Mods, because it's their channel, they own the subscriber base, I guess, and we couldn't really make a living out of it, which is not what we originally wanted to do. But eventually we figured it was either all or nothing. Like, you either have to do it as a job, or it's just a bit of fun and don't take it too seriously. So we ended up just starting our own channel, which is with the Skid Factory, which is a silly name. It's not because we build burnout cars. It's just what my friends used to call my shed, because we always used it to build silly cars that they would then go to car festivals, like roll racing events or whatever, and do burnouts in, whatever, you know. It's just colloquial language for building cars that have a bit of power. So we had to pick a name, so that's what it was.
I'm assuming at this point YouTube is your income. This is how you make your living. There's no sort of side hustle. The side hustle has become the main hustle.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, that's been the case for about 3.5-4 years, maybe.
I'm guessing that there'll probably be some people out there in the audience who either have their own YouTube channel or are considering that as a career path. In terms of monetizing it, how are you doing this? Is this through sort of partnerships and sponsors, YouTube revenue as well, or solely YouTube revenue?
No, it's YouTube revenue is not great unless you've got a lot more viewers and subs than we do. So if you're one of those 3 million plus subscribers with a million views on each video, then you probably are making a good living out of YouTube revenue. But in our case, we're about 255,000 subs, and we get like 80,000 to 100,000 views per episode, like once a week sort of thing, which is, it's good for a small Australian YouTube about a very niche thing. So the majority of our income comes from other sources. So we have sponsorships with various brands and like relevant stuff, tools, machinery, componentry, like car parts, that sort of thing, ECUs, like Haltech. We're ambassador for them. We use their stuff. We're very careful not to be, not to turn into salesmen or anything like that. It's just integrated into what we do. We would use it anyway, so it works for everyone.
I think it's really important to be genuine, because people's bullshit radars these days are fairly finely tuned. So, you know, if it becomes very obvious, I think, if you're watching a YouTube video and you can see that the person is pushing a product because they're getting a big paycheck at the end of it versus something that they truly believe in.
Yeah, that's correct. We always knew that it's a slow build. Like it's this sort of stuff doesn't happen overnight. So it takes years to get better at it for a start, because, yeah, obviously, as I said, we were incredibly wooden and not comfortable on camera when we first started, and that goes away with time, and you'd probably be familiar with that, being a presenter yourself.
I will not watch my early videos. It's a cringe fest. But I mean, no one sort of gets in front of a camera and is Tom Cruise their very first time they open their mouth. You need time to learn how to do anything. So being in front of a camera is absolutely no different. Okay, I just wanted to sort of get a bit of a sense of what that journey looked like, and, you know, sort of a overnight success that has taken 5 years, I guess, at this point.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. Yeah.
I want to move on, and I want to talk about something that's near and dear to the collective hearts of High Performance Academy, and I know has triggered a couple of our guys, particularly our editor Petey, who's a massive Hikoska fan, and also Connor, who's doing some videos for us on 3D modeling and CAD. And you guys took a Hikoska, which is a very rare and now very expensive car. And tell us what you did to it.
Yeah, so it's a 1971 Skyline two-door, basically what the original GTR was, but it isn't a GTR, so that's definitely a point of difference. We would never have done anything to a real GTR, because they are truly very valuable. This one it's valuable and cool. But the owner of the car, he actually just emailed me one day years ago and said, "Oh, I've got this car and I want to do an engine swap on it, because the original engine it's all original, old, worn out. It's obviously a 2-liter six cylinder, so L series engine, so it was never very powerful in the first place." So he was throwing ideas around, such as VQ35s, which I absolutely would not allow, because they're not a very good engine in my opinion. No offense to all the VQ35 owners out there, but
I had one, and I'd have to probably back you on that.
Not a bad engine, but just not very inspiring. Let's say that. So what we ended up looking into was Nissan V8s, because I'd actually spent a bit of time fiddling around with Nissan V8s, which are actually quite rare in Australia, probably compared to even New Zealand or America. Like we didn't get any cars with them in, so any of them were just imported Japanese engines, which I was prone to buying willy-nilly years ago when they came up as very cheap engines because no one wanted them. So I'd had a bit of experience with them, and I liked the construction of them. They were similar to Toyota V8, very, very well put together, very well engineered as a factory engine, like overdone compared to what you would expect from a Ford or Holden engine, particularly back in the 90s. So we ended up going with a VK56 Nissan Titan engine, which we had built by Hartley's Motorsport in New Zealand, and it wasn't easy to fit.
It's a big engine for a relatively small engine bay.
It is a fairly big engine, so we had to make wholesale changes to the steering design and the suspension design in the car. We didn't want to chop the car up in any noticeable fashion, because it's quite a sort of rare car, so it can all be turned back to stock. If you really wanted to, I don't know why you would, but that quite often makes people feel better about it if we tell them that you could change it back. But yeah, so it's actually a fairly mild engine. It's only a sort of a street build engine. It's got factory pistons and that sort of thing in it. So it was more of an economy sort of dollar-wise setup rather than the race engines that they built for the stock cars. but it's also a lot of engine for a small car, which is basically a little bit bigger than a Datsun 1600 and pretty much the same sort of suspension. So it's very 1971 in its handling and all the rest of it. We did put new brakes on it. We did everything that was sort of to upgrade the car to suit the engine.
And one of the problems you quite often come across with engine conversions like this, particularly where you've got a small engine bay and you're fitting a lot of engine in there, is cooling. Particularly, you obviously got an engine making a lot more power, which you need to dissipate heat. The cooling requirements go up. Any issues with that, or is there enough room in the front of the Skyline to fit a sizable radiator?
Yeah, that's always a thing that's got to be considered when we do engine swaps. We do a lot of engine swaps just because I just like doing them. So yeah, the cooling side of things, there wasn't much room for a radiator at all. So I ended up fitting what I could radiator-wise, which ended up being a Volkswagen Corrado radiator, like a VR6 something, like a Mark III Golf or something, just randomly. That's what fitted the space. And I also then fitted a large oil cooler on it because I wanted to take advantage of oil as a coolant, because the oil does a lot of it reaches every place in the engine that the coolant doesn't, probably more. So there's a lot of heat transfer that goes into the oil. So I took advantage of that, and we ran an oil cooler, and it's perfect. Doesn't get hot. It doesn't have thermostatic control or anything like that, because that's the way the engine was delivered to us. It's more or less a street version of a race engine, so to speak. We did have problems with oil pickup because we made a custom sump for it, because it's out of a four-wheel drive, so it has an enormous sump system on it that's for a car that's probably literally twice the size of it, so none of that would fit. We did what we could, and we had dramas with the pickup. I don't know, we thought it was big enough, but it didn't work anyway, so we had issues with high RPM oil pressure dropping. So cavitation was a suggestion, but no one was going in deep enough to know exactly what was causing it. But
high RPM is definitely not the place you want to be getting oil pressure fluctuations either.
Yeah, exactly.
So the solution there, bite the bullet and dry sump?
Yeah, I have a good friend that's actually a pattern maker, so not many people can probably say that. So he actually just made us a pattern and built us a dry sump pan for that engine, which was a little bit complicated due to the way it picks up its oil and delivers its oil through the sump casing, which is not very convenient when you're trying to build a dry sump. But we got there with the help of other friends. I have a lot of skilled friends, and I call on them, and they do a great job. We got that sorted, got an Aviate, I think, just a scavenge pump, so two-stage scavenge, and retained the original pump inside the engine and a tank, and that all worked really well. So
problem solved.
Yeah, it just took a little bit, but we solved the problem, so it's all good.
It's interesting that you managed to retain the factory pump as the pressure stage, because typically this will be an external pump with 2, 3, or maybe 4 scavenge stages, which suck the oil and blow-by gases out of the crankcase or the sump, and then pump them back to a reservoir, wherever that may be. And then the other stage of that will be the pressure stage, which draws the oil from the reservoir and then pumps it through the engine. So you actually found that, obviously you found that the factory oil pump was sufficient to draw that forward and do that.
Yeah, so the engine had been dynoed on an engine dyno prior to being sent to Australia, so we knew that everything was working, but it had a factory Titan sump on it, so we knew that there was no issue with the pump itself. It was always the way that we designed the sump, which was very much compromised by by space. And to be honest, I wasn't surprised that it didn't work, but we tried it that way and then moved on from there. So there was no problems actually keeping that pump. It was brand new Nissan item. Never had a problem on the engine dyno. So yeah, feeding that pump straight from the dry sump tank that would normally go to that pressure stage on the dry sump pump, it worked perfectly fine. Yeah. So, and apparently it's not uncommon to do it that way, I found out from asking around. So
I guess as long as you've got a factory pump that's up to the task, a cost saving as well, plus simplicity.
Yeah. as you know, the modern stuff definitely has a lot better oil pumps in them than they did back in the 60s, 70s, 80s on an old Chev or something like that.
In terms of final results with this, I saw one of your dyno videos, but this was at the stage that you were still suffering some oil pressure problems. What did you end up making out of it, and what sort of RPM range is it rev to?
I think it made 450 horsepower at about just under 7,000, but it'll happily go to 8, but obviously it peak power was happening prior to that, so that's a lot for that car. Probably not.
No doubt.
Yeah, it's probably not a lot for the engine itself. I think there's probably potentially should be more in it. The individual throttle bodies are definitely a compromise on a street engine for sure. They're incredibly finicky. They're very large, so that first initial throttle crack is akin to half throttle on a normal throttle body. So it was quite difficult to tune around to sort of make it a bit more street drivable, particularly in a car that's so light and it's manual transmission, of course. So
not so good in the peak hour traffic stop start.
No, it's definitely not built for that. But I mean, yeah, as you can see, it's not really a peak hour traffic car anyway, but it's just a Sunday car, really. It was just the owner's had it for 14 or 15 years, I think, now, and he just drives it on a Sunday and enjoys it, takes it to those sort of track days where you're just not racing anyone but having a bit of a squirt here and there and has fun, and that's probably the main thing.
Sounds like fun to me. Let's just talk a little bit about the rest of the drivetrain. So as you mentioned, the VK56 in stock form, Titan truck, four-wheel drive, so obviously the factory transmission from that is not an option. So where did you go to there?
In Australia, the best manual transmission or the easiest manual transmission for us to get is a Tremec, like a TR6060 out of a V8 Commodore. They're very common, particularly the type that doesn't have an extension housing with a slip yoke, because they're much more difficult for people to use as a transmission for conversions, because no slip yoke means you've got to mess around with adapters and things like that, and they just tend to be forgotten. So I got one of them very cheap. They're virtually bulletproof. They're built for a very high torque, heavy Commodore. So, and amongst other things, they're fitted to many other high powered cars as well. So we went with one of those, and the guys at Hartley's actually made a bell housing out of CNC parts and sheet metal, which I was astonished at, because I've never seen it done that way. But
interesting combination.
Yeah. True to form, it actually just bolted straight up, so that was excellent.
That's always the tricky part with any transmission swap, is the adaption. I mean, these days for some of the common swaps, there are off-the-shelf bell housings or adapter plates that are available, but doing that custom can be pretty tricky, and I think a lot of people also overlook the fact that getting the input shaft of the gearbox running true with the center line of the crankshaft, that's super critical, and just a few thousandths of an inch off central or concentric, and you're going to end up with problems with bearing life or seals and all sorts of nasty stuff you don't really want to go into, correct?
Yeah, that's right. I've had my fair share of transmission conversions over time, and I'm not sure why I still do them, because they aren't much fun at all. So if you can find one that bolts on, just buy that. It's much less headache.
Probably not a lot of kit sets for VK56 into 70s Skyline with Tremec transmission, though.
Yeah, that's correct. I couldn't seem to Google that one out, so we went with that. Fortunately, because it's such a common transmission, there is drawings for them for the front plate, and it was all done via drawings and via my measurements from here to New Zealand. So hence why I was very happy when it actually just worked, because obviously it doesn't always work that way.
Love it when a plan comes together just like it's supposed to.
Yeah. You got to have a win sometimes, I think, is what we normally say.
I guess the $1 million question with this is how many hours of your life have you at this point wasted battling the comments on your YouTube videos about why you should never cut up a classic Hikoska?
I don't know why, but we generally have very positive comments on our channel. I don't know whether people just don't bother commenting, or whether we explain it to a point where they sometimes I preempt and just answer the question that I know that they're gonna, or statement that they're not, I know that they're gonna say that. I know that they're going to, but everything has a reason and why we've done it. And we try to explain that during the process is we're using this because of this, we're using that because of that. And I don't know, it seems to work okay because we don't generally get hostile commenters. And I'm more than happy to engage with them and talk about it. And if it's just, I don't like it, well, that's neither here nor there.
Yeah, it's a personal preference and it's not going to suit everyone. I think that's important with the whole automotive scene. You're not building it for someone else. So whether they like it or they don't, it really doesn't matter. As long as the dude paying the bills is happy with the end result, really, ultimately, that's all that counts. All right, Al, we'll move on to wrapping this thing up. And we've got the same three questions we ask all of our guests. And the first of those is, what's next in the future for you and your Skid Factory channel?
We have a lot of projects in planning. We've probably got a few years worth of projects that could be ready to go at any time. And it's basically comes down to when we can fit them into the shed. It's only a very small 12x9 shed, so it's not a warehouse. So we do what we can do while we can do it. And usually the next project that comes up is basically whoever's ready. You know, if your car's ready and your budget's ready and we're good to go. So providing there's no overlap with one what we've just done. Can't have too many Barras or LSs on the channel at one time.
Yeah, variety is the spice of life there.
Yeah, and the variety side of it comes from me because I don't want to work on the same thing twice. I want to move to a different type of vehicle, a different engine. A lot of the time I want to use an engine that I've never used before because I'm fascinated with the way engines are put together and how they operate and that sort of thing. So we've got a few unusual things on the go. I'm stepping into the diesel drag racing foray, which is very daunting.
Interesting.
If there's anything that you can't Google, it's how to build a diesel drag car.
You're right. There's not as much information out there in the diesel performance world. We found that as well.
Yeah. If you want to offer me any advice, or call me.
Definitely not in a position to do that, unfortunately. It's not my area of expertise either, but it'll be interesting. Any sort of intention to expand the team, bring in more talent or anything of that nature? Are you quite happy the way it is at the moment with the two of you?
I'm quite happy with it the way it is. I think we do about 20% work and 80% editing and just general organisation and that sort of thing. So having a workshop helper is not really, it wouldn't work. And we have an editor helper that works for us, but he just obviously works from home. So at the moment, we're just happy that we've achieved something that not many people can, and that's somehow become a popular automotive YouTube channel. It's just, I mean, as you know, it's a lot of hard work and it could just not work for no reason, no fault of your own. So
yeah, hats off to you. It's a hard grind to reach the level of success that you're seeing. So yeah, congratulations. Next question, Al. Is there any advice you'd give to a younger version of yourself or maybe one of our listeners to help fast track your career progress and get you to where you are now? I mean, I don't know, maybe that's just start a YouTube channel straight away, but obviously you need all of that experience and knowledge to start with. Any insights you can give us?
I'd say I never thought, there's no such thing as YouTube for a start when I started being a mechanic. But advice I'd give myself is don't doubt yourself, because I was very doubtful of my abilities most of my life. And even though half of me would say, yeah, you got this, the other half would say, no, don't do that. So if I could do it again, I'd go, nah, just go out and do it. Get involved in racing, spend more time with cars rather than, like, I'd work on them and then never drive them. So I never had that much of that experience of racing, and I've started doing that just recently at my age, like I'm nearly 50. So don't doubt yourself, give it a go. It doesn't matter if it doesn't work, wake up the next morning and go again.
Yeah, I think we've said a number of times on this podcast so far, but it does bear reiterating. Don't be afraid of failure. It's essentially, I think, what you're getting at here. Obviously, you do want to have some confidence in your ability and be able to back yourself. But you know, when you're stepping into an area that you're inexperienced and you're learning, failures are going to happen. But I think we learn more often from our failures than our successes. So yeah, don't be afraid of that, I think is really important. All right, our last question for today. If people want to follow you, if they haven't already watched your channel, where are they best to do so?
So on YouTube, we're The Skid Factory, and that should be pretty easy to find there. We've also got same name on Instagram, TikTok, all those things. I've got Turbo Yoda TSF on Instagram, but don't expect too much out of me because I'm a bit old for that. I do my best. But yeah, Facebook, all that. We've obviously got like a fan club on Facebook and that sort of thing where we all get involved, and our main goal is to get people enjoying working on cars, interested in it, and having a go. So we like to try and nurture that sort of that side of things. And also we're heavily into men's mental health and looking after yourselves. It's not easy being a bloke in this day and age, and we like to encourage people to look after their mates and ask them how they're going and that sort of thing.
Fantastic. That's really rewarding doing something like that as well. So congratulations on everything you're doing. Thanks for your time today, Al, and we wish you all the best, and also look forward to watching you potentially, maybe not, cut up some classic Japanese cars in the future. Cheers.
I'll try to behave myself in the future. Thanks, Andre. And also, I'm a massive fan of this podcast. It's incredibly educational, and I certainly enjoy it while I'm in the shed chopping up Japanese classics.
I appreciate the kind words. All right. Thanks, Al.
Thanks, mate.
If you enjoyed this episode of Tuned In with Al Butler, we'd love it if you could drop a review on your chosen podcasting platform. These reviews really help us to grow our audience, and that, in turn, helps us to continue to get more high-quality guests. To say thanks, each week we'll be picking a random reviewer and sending them out an HPA t-shirt free of charge anywhere in the world. Also, this is a great place to ask any questions you might have too, and I'll do my best to answer them if your review gets picked. So this week, a big shout out to Mark Wilkinson from Australia, who has said, absolute ripper of a show, huge fan of the podcast. The nuggets of info in each show have helped me get both into and out of trouble many times with my own project. Keep up the great work. Well, thanks for the feedback there, Mark. And Mark's also asked a question. He's asked, one thing I'd love to hear is the reverse of what's normally talked about. I have an old Carby Datsun I'm converting to turbo EFI and deconstructing the old loom, then adding a new engine harness. Am I best to just leave the old harness in as it's tied into the body loom, or just lay in a new EFI loom on top and add a new fuse box? Honestly, Mark, I would absolutely be getting rid of the original harness. It's going to be pretty basic. You're not going to need any of it. It's going to be much easier just to build your own harness. And then you can either add a fuse box or simply take a power feed off from the existing fuse box for what you're going to need. Anyway, Mark, get in touch with us with your t-shirt size and shipping details, and we'll fire a fresh tee straight out to you. All right, that concludes our interview. And before we sign off, I just wanted to mention, for anyone who's been perhaps hiding under a rock and hasn't heard of High Performance Academy before, we are an online training school, and we specialize in teaching a range of performance automotive topics, everything from engine tuning and engine building through to wiring, car suspension and wheel alignment, data analysis, and race driver education. Now, remember, you've got that coupon code. You can use podcast75 at the checkout to get $75 off the purchase of your first course. You'll find our full course list at hpacademy.com/courses. Important to mention that when you purchase a course from us, that course is yours for life as well. It never expires. You can rewatch the course as many times as you like, whenever you like. The purchase of a course will also give you 3 months of access to our gold membership. That gives you access to our private members only forum, which is the perfect place to get answers to your specific questions. You'll also get access to our regular weekly members webinars, which is where we touch on a particular topic in the performance automotive realm. We dive into that topic for about an hour. If you can watch live, you can ask questions and get answers in real time. If the time zones don't work for you, that's fine too. You're going to get access as a gold member to our previous webinar archive. We've got close to 300 hours of existing content in that archive. It is an absolute goldmine. So remember that coupon code podcast75. Check out our course list at hpacademy.com/courses.